You heard him this morning on Matt Adams Show. He's a web.com tour winner. He is now an author. Tour Confidential is the name of the book. Ewan, welcome to the show. How's it going, my friend?
I'm very well. Thanks, John. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I wish we could have spaced it out a little bit, but unfortunately, fortunately for you, you were headed overseas here shortly, are you not?
Correct, yeah. Next Monday, I'm away for 3 weeks down in Central and South America for the start of the 2013 web.com season, which I'm looking forward to. I haven't played too much over the past 9 months, and I'm really looking forward to getting the season underway, hopefully with a bang.
Well, no doubt. And that Panama trip is an awfully good one. It's a lot of fun. Let's talk about the book. What inspired you to sit down and to actually pound this out and to go through the grind of writing a book?
Yeah, that's a good question. In October 2011, I'd returned home to Australia, and I didn't have any status on the Australasian PGA Tour, and I'd had a very poor season over here in the United States. And I guess I really didn't have too much to do, and I started jotting down some memories on a piece of paper. And initially I thought, well, hang on, this could be something I could show my kids or grandkids one day, when, what their dad or what their grandfather got up to when he was a touring professional. And I got to about 15,000-20,000 words, I would say, before I started thinking that I could turn this into something a little more. And I didn't have any history or background in writing. It was just, I guess it was just something that came fairly naturally to me, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And now it's sort of exceeded expectations so far, and regardless of how it does perform, I'm very proud of the fact that I have written a book.
Yeah, you should be. As an English major, as somebody who calls himself a columnist, this is quite an accomplishment, no doubt. I want to ask you, because I've considered penning something similar, and I was afraid that, too many of the guilty would be exposed if I wrote a book. What were your concerns once you realized that this is actually going to be somewhere that the folks that I'm talking about are actually going to be, I'm going to play with them, and they're going to be in the book?
Yeah, correct. Well, I don't expose anyone for illegal substances or infidelity. Same as any area of life, any walk of life. Well, it happens, but I didn't need to tread on any toes there in that regard. But I'm not too overly concerned about it. I'd be lying if I said it doesn't bother me at all, because I do care about other people's feelings and that. But everything I've said is the truth. And really, the reason behind it was to just give the public an insight into the daily rigors of our lifestyle and what we go through out on the road. And I also thought that I could maybe my words and my stories could be used as a guideline for any aspiring professional thinking of trying to make a living out of the game.
Well, you've had some tremendous highs and some tremendous lows in the game, and that's why I think that your story in particular lends itself to the literary world. Was it at all painful dredging up some of those memories?
It was. It's been a painful process along the way, obviously, too, but definitely writing my last decade as a professional golfer conjured up some fond memories and some pretty painful ones too. But I think one of the things that became very clear is just how, as professional golfers, we don't tend to pat ourselves on the back enough when we do achieve some good things. I mean, we're forever practicing and grinding and doing all we can to get better at this game. And I won twice on tour and played in 3 British Open championships. And most professional golfers would love to have achieved what I've achieved. But I always was aiming higher and comparing myself to the guys on the PGA Tour and the guys that are top 50 in the world, and looking at my career as someone who had underachieved and not achieved enough. And therefore, I started putting pressure on myself, and it snowballed and it led down a path of self-destruction, I guess you could say. And, I think I'm glad I've got the perspective I have now after writing everything down. I guess, fortunately for me, that's been the case. A lot of us out there don't realize, how lucky we are to be playing the game for a living. And that was certainly the case for me 12 months ago. But it's been quite therapeutic what I've done, and I'm happy to be sitting here now and have a little better idea of what I've got to do when I do get back out there.
We're talking to Ewan Porter, who is a web.com tour player, Australasian tour player. He's played all over the world. But it sounds, Ewan, if for the listeners out there, I think I'm going to surprise some people when I say you're only 30 years old. You sound like a wise old soul when you're telling this story.
Sorry, that was a bad line there, John. What was that? I sound like a what? Sorry, a wise old soul?
Yes, you sound, you're, what you've written and what you say belies your 30 years. You sound like you've been around a lot longer than that.
Yeah, well, honestly, I'd like to think that's the case. If you asked a few of my friends, they'd probably laugh at that comment. But maybe on the occasional Friday and Saturday night, that's not the case. But honestly, I really do think that what I've experienced has hardened me. It's made me a better character. I'm more humble. I appreciate what we do a hell of a lot more. It's not to say that going forward, I'm not going to get pissed off if things don't go the way I want them to, but I just hope that I don't lose sight of the big picture anymore, which definitely happened in the years gone by.
In 2010, when you showed up in Valdosta, you had everything you owned in the car.
Yep.
You and your girlfriend at the time, I don't know how that, if that has run its course or not, or but you guys had packed up and you were all in. You'd pushed all the chips on the table and you won the golf tournament. And it seemed like from there, and I was fortunate enough to be part of the broadcast crew, and we made a big deal about the fact that you were committing everything to it. What happened from that point over the next year?
Well, I take it back to 2008. I won the Moonar Classic on the Australasian PGA Tour, which was co-sanctioned with the old Nationwide Tour then. And I played the Nationwide Tour in 2005, and I think I only made 3 of 20 cuts, and I was raw, and I had no idea what to expect. When I won Moonar in 2008, everybody made a huge deal out of the way I won, the fashion that I won, by 7 strokes and shot the low round the last day, etc. And basically, you know, the world was my oyster. I had the world at my feet, and I placed the most unrealistic expectations on myself when I came over here. I thought that because I won by 7 strokes, that winning another 2 events and going straight onto the tour that year was probably going to happen. And then once things started going south, I didn't realize why. Come 2010, when I won Valdosta, once again, that was completely unexpected. I'd missed my first 6 cuts that year, and kind of the progression that my professional career has been or has taken, you know, it was not surprising to some people that I won, because, you know, I'd proven that I could before, and I'd had some good results, but the path that I was heading going into that event certainly didn't give me any reason to think that I was going to win. I had a little bit more of an understanding of what I'd be going through and what would be expected of me second time around when I won. But, you know, unless you're out there and you experience it and you can really understand the pressures that are placed on you to, you know, to realize your dream, to get out there, it's hard to really put a finger on one thing in particular that led to me, I guess, struggling again the second time around, because, you know, I in hindsight, I practiced way too much. I played way too much. I don't know. I mean, I felt like I could never get away from golf in my weeks off. I was renting in Scottsdale, Arizona after that for 6 months, and instead of taking 4 or 5 days off after a 3 or 4 week stretch, I'd take a day off and then I'd be back grinding again. And, you know, I think I burnt myself out both physically and mentally. And this is all part and parcel of what's in my book. You know, there's a hell of a lot more that goes into it than just hitting a fairway, hitting a green and holding the putt. It's a marathon out there. And unless you can accept that fact, it's, you know, it can be a long and difficult road.
You know, I thought one of the more interesting comments in the off season when the whole world was talking about Rory McIlroy changing equipment, I liked what Graham McDowell said, in that he said, it's not the equipment that's going to give Rory any troubles if there's troubles. It's the expectations that he places on himself and that others place on him. And you're basically saying the exact same thing, is that, you know, expectations could be your worst nightmare.
Oh, there's no question about it. And I made a comment to Matt Adams this morning when I was on his show, and just little things like, you know, I certainly don't use this as a self-pity or anything, but I don't come from an overly wealthy family or anything, and that was one of the things, I guess, in my initial years as a golf pro, and it kept on happening throughout my career. I was just trying way too hard to get on the tour and make money and help my parents out, who had never had too much. And they want nothing more. I know deep down they want nothing more than me to go out there and give it my best shot and be happy. They don't care probably if I miss 10, 15 cuts a year, so long as I'm happy. And but deep down, I was just putting unrealistic expectations on myself and trying hard for other people, rather than just doing it for myself and doing what came naturally to me as a kid, which was just to go out, have fun, play golf, and the results take care of themselves.
Well, and you mentioned you're about to leave this week for a new year. Does writing the book, you mentioned it was cathartic, does it take some of the weight off of your shoulders, and you feel like you can just go out and play and have fun now?
I definitely think to a degree, there's no question about it. I mean, I still want to go out there and give it my best shot this year and realize my dream of playing on the PGA Tour and hopefully go on to bigger and better things. But I definitely feel like having written the book, I guess it's a little easier for me when I do get back out there. I think that laying everything out in writing has made me feel a little more comfortable about things, and I kind of understand the progress I've got to make and the pathway I've got to take. I don't want to burn myself out again, but I hope that it does make things easier for me. But, you know, it's still going to be a process. I think it always will be, and as Jack Nicklaus said, you're always learning.
This year on the Web.com Tour, the structure's different. You have to get yourself into the four tournament series. If you're in the top 25, your position's set, but obviously, if you're not in that top 25, but you are in the top 75, you've got an opportunity in a four tournament series at the end of the season to play your way onto the PGA Tour. Does that change the mindset at all of a player for the year? Does it change your scheduling? Does it change any approach?
I think scheduling, definitely. There's no question about it. And I mean, the way the tour is structured this year, there are certain weeks off where I think the majority of guys are going to be playing nearly every event, because from my recollection, there's only 20 or 21 events on the schedule prior to the playoff series in September, and therefore I think you're going to find that the majority of guys play at least 18 of the events, and you really have to. I mean, it's still a marathon. It's still 18 to 24 round events. I mean, it's a lot of golf, and I think from memory, five of those events are overseas, so and they're all earlier in the year. But at the end of the day, I mean, you do have to make the most of your opportunities, and you do have to make those playoffs. And making the top 75 on the money list isn't as easy as what it seems. It's very tough out there. I mean, there's a lot of cuts that are 5 and 6 under par on 7,200 yard courses, so you've got to be golfing your ball. And you've got to knuckle down and make the most of it, for sure.
It's the toughest dollar in golf. I mean, you've played all over the world. They cut to 60, which makes it that much tougher. And yeah, and you're right. If you're not 4 or 5 under par, I don't care how hard the golf course is, you have the weekend off. It's that dog eat dog out there. And that is a different kind of pressure to know that you have to go low.
I made a point of that in my book, actually, John. I said that I think between the beginning of 2010 and the end of 2011, I'd missed 13 cuts by one stroke. And, you know, if I was playing the Australasian Tour or the Asian Tour with the scores I was shooting, I would have only missed most probably 3 or 4 of those cuts. And there's a huge difference between spending 10 weekends off and playing and making money 10 of those weekends. It was a huge dent to my confidence. And it goes to show what a fine line it is between being really successful and grinding away and being miserable in your hotel room in the middle of nowhere. It's difficult. But, I mean, how difficult is that? I mean, 13 cuts by one stroke. I think 8 or 9 of those events I was under par for the two rounds. So it's not like I was playing really poorly. But when you're having the weekend off, it's only natural to feel like you're struggling. And then you start working harder and you may not really need to. It's only a shot or two here and there. Maybe it's a lucky bounce or not. But I think as golfers, as you know, we tend to overanalyze things. And I've certainly been guilty of that. And that's and it's something else that I think I've really seen through my writing is don't be too hard on myself. I mean, everyone can say that to you. A lot of people have said that to me in the past. Obviously, I've been way too hard on myself, but it's only when I sat back and really thought about things that I got to see that.
You and David Duvall once said that the most important thing that any professional athlete can do is protect his confidence. And David's one of the smarter guys that the game's ever seen. Obviously, a former number one player in the world, a British Open champion. When you hear the phrase "protect your confidence," what does that mean to you?
Well, it rings very true. There's no question about it. And I mean, protect your confidence. Once again, yes, it's correct. You hit the nail on the head. But how do you protect your confidence? And that's something that I feel I go into in my book. I talk about the importance of having a mentor, the importance of having a good team of people around you. Both of those, I never had those. I never had that. I went out there and thought that I was going to set the world on fire early, and it never happened. And I didn't know what to do when things started heading south. And to protect your confidence, I mean, if you can have someone to turn to and a shoulder to lean on when things aren't going well, I think that's of the utmost importance. And that's what I have said to a couple of rookies, actually, on tour this year. I've said, you know, it's very important for you to have a good team of people around you because, you know, you want someone to be able to speak to when you've just missed two or three cuts in a row. And especially for me, coming from the other side of the world, it can be very difficult and a lonely existence when you're over here and you're spending the weekend in your hotel room not doing anything and you've got no one to turn to. It's not easy, but, you know, upon reflection, it's certainly built a tough character, a tough, you know, exterior and interior in my being, I think.
Who are you working with now? Who's your swing coach?
Just doing my own thing at the moment, and I'm actually happy to be doing that. I never had a proper golf lesson until I was 23, and if I had my time again, that would be the case. I would not have a lesson at all. I think in golf, ignorance can be bliss, and going back to the overanalyzing statement that I made earlier, you know, when I hit bad shots when I was younger, I never thought about it too much. I'd get annoyed with it, but I'd almost look forward to the challenge of the next. And I think between the ages of 23 and 28, I'm not sure if there's a coach I didn't see or someone I didn't ask about my swing. And every single shot, I was trying something different on the backswing or the downswing or the setup. And you cannot enjoy golf that way. I mean, even if you're shooting 65 or 66, you walk off absolutely exhausted mentally for the fact that you haven't just played out there. You've been worried about your swing, and you know, you might shoot 65 and go to the range after it and work on something so minor because it didn't look absolutely technically perfect. And it's not a fun way to be, and there's no longevity with that being the case. So I feel like I'm in a pretty good place right now with where my technique's at. And as the old saying goes, for the most part, it's inches between the ears for me.
Well, I tell you, it's a triumph. We're looking forward to the year. I've read excerpts of the book. I haven't downloaded the whole thing, but I certainly plan to. There's excerpts at golfdigest.com. Tour Confidential is available at Amazon, eBooks, you name it. It's out there. You and Porter did this all by himself. What I have to ask you before I let you go, when you sent it in, when you sent the book off, after you had finished it, were you nervous about the reaction? Did you think that it was going to be published and available all over the world? What were your thoughts? What were your expectations for the book?
Yeah, when I sent it into the ebook publishing company that I went through out in Oregon, it felt like a triumph to me just to send it off because it had been such an arduous process and just finalizing all the details, editing it, and going through little bits and pieces just to double check that it was all correct, and getting people to look at, getting a couple of people just to sort of share their wisdom on it. And when I did send it off, I wasn't worried initially about what would happen. When it was released on November the 9th, I had a few people within the first couple of weeks of its release not saying the nicest things to me because I'd exposed their names in the book, but I was a little concerned about that at the start and a little upset that they felt that way, but it's nothing, it's certainly nothing major. And as I said, I really don't feel like I've trod on too many toes. That certainly wasn't the goal out of it. The goal out of it was to just give a good insight into what we go through out there as professional golfers. And everything that's happened in there is the truth. And you know, that's all I can do. I just wanted to tell my story because I felt like my story resonates with thousands of other golf pros around the world, and no one in my position had really done that before and put their lives out there for all to see. And I thought, why not? If people can learn by it, well, then the book has served its purpose.
Two very well-known golf personalities wrote forewords or tributes to the book, Jerry Foltz and Peter Senior. How did that come about, and what did it mean to you to read their words?
Oh, I mean, especially, well, obviously Peter Senior, with him being a you know, fellow Australian and someone I looked up to growing up, it means the world to me. And I had a practice round with Peter at the British Open in 2010 at St Andrews, and to play with one of my idols at the home of golf was really special. And I don't think you could find one person in the world that would say a bad word about Peter. He's a lovely guy, and it's good to see him succeeding on the Champions Tour now. Foltzy, Jerry Foltz, I've known him for a good 7 or 8 years now since I first became a member of the tour, and you know, Jerry's a fantastic guy. And I, to be honest with you, his words meant, I think, more to me than anyone else, because it was really, I think, a true reflection of my character. And Jerry, if you're listening, thank you.
Well, he does listen on occasion, but remember, it's 6:25 in the East, so if he's not working, he's in a bar somewhere.
No, but honest, yeah, no, I understand that. That probably is the case, but no, that was there are a lot of guys who put a little tributes in there, and every single one of them meant the world to me. Former caddies, fellow players, past champions, idols of mine, media personalities, and come to think of it, I didn't ask you, John. Definitely, maybe the next book you can write the foreword for me.
Well, Jack Newton is a pretty good character to have write your foreword as well. It's fantastic. I look forward to finishing it. We're pulling for you, and congratulations.
Thank you very much, John. I appreciate the time.